Good morning. I'm actually really nervous about speaking today, and I'm not normally nervous about speaking here, so here we go. Could be the cold. I'm so cold I've left my shoes on. I normally speak without my shoes on. That's a sign. Okay. I grew up with a traditional view of LGBTIQ sexuality, that it was wrong, and that people should be celibate if they couldn't be heterosexual. I believed this, and I taught this. I was in a youth ministry. Until in my early 20s, I met LGBTIQ Christians, which busted my head, to be honest, at the time. And I listened to their stories of pain and exclusion. And then I had to go back to my Bible that I thought I knew and see how these people who I could see were so genuine, how they would fit into my scriptures. And over several years, I was converted to a position that welcomes people of any sexuality into the family of God. Now, I'm not going to today try and change anyone's mind, because changing minds and changing hearts, which is more important, is a long and slow process. But I'm inviting us to listen to some possibilities, and to understand how people may genuinely hold texts differently and all be seeking to serve the same God. So first, I need to say I'm going to be using the word homosexuality as a catch-all for something that's much more diverse than that, but it's really hard to say for half an hour, so I'm going to say, but I'm catching in that all sorts of diversity. I also want to say, for those of you who this is your personal story, please can you extend me the grace of speaking in a theoretical way today? It's not a kind way to speak about anyone's personal story, but I can't find another way to stand up here and speak in general. When we're talking about sexuality, we have to consider three axes, let's say. One is sex, our actual biology, the physical makeup of who we are. Another is gender, which is our identity, our inner sense of self, and our cultural construction of who we are. And our sexual orientation, which is who we're attracted to. So I'm a female, that's my biology. I'm a woman, my inner sense of self is as a woman. If I had a hysterectomy and a mastectomy, I would still be just as much a woman, even though my biology was less female. And I'm heterosexual. Now, that pairing is very socially convenient, but it's not a universal alignment for everyone. And what's more, those three axes are not polarities, they're all scales, gradual scales, where people in the middle are somewhere between, and there's scales. So once you've got three graded scales intersecting, and you are plotted somewhere in those three, we have a vast diversity of humanity that we're dealing with. Hence why it's LGBTQI+. And all of us bring to this discussion implicit beliefs of what we think homosexuality is. And they fall roughly into four categories. The first is that homosexuality is a free choice. Now, for most, this comes about saying this worldview is that it's a conscious, rebellious choice against something that's intended, and that leads to paradigms where the appropriate response is repentance and behaviour change and being welcomed into the grace of God, or condemnation for those who don't wish to repent. Within this same worldview of homosexuality as a choice, there's also people, often sort of radical feminists, for whom there's a desire to reclaim control over bodies. Elizabeth Stewart says, once again, we have to reclaim our bodies from tolerant liberals who accept us because we can't help it, and claim the freedom to choose to whom we relate sexually. So you can see within this sense of the free choice, there's two quite different understandings of how, but the same sense that it's a choice. A second position is that homosexuality is an illness, or a deep flaw, a deep brokenness, from which one might hope to be cured. So it's something akin to, say, alcoholism. It's a profound drive that might have been born into us, maybe like greed. But it should not therefore be encouraged. that it arises out of original sin. And so the solution to that, like alcoholism, is abstinence, possibly counselling to assist with behaviour change. Within this kind of grouping, some go so far as to see it as demon possession, which requires exorcism. But most consider celibacy an appropriate response. The third grouping is those who see homosexuality as a tragedy of nature. So this is a tragic flaw arising... No, I've got those two mixed up. One is that arising out of original sin can either be that it's an illness or that it's just a flaw, like a disability, like infertility. And the correct response to a disability, a tragic disability, is compassion and accommodation to allow people to live the fullest life possible. Some people advocating gay marriage fit into this area because there's a sense of, well, marriage is a man and a woman, but if through some tragedy of birth you don't have access to that marriage, then we can grant you access to a lifelong partnership like marriage. The fourth rough area of how we hold this is that homosexuality is a created variety of nature, like being an introvert or an extrovert, tall or short, left or right-handed. So it's something that enriches all of us by widening our experience, by bringing different perspectives. And so the appropriate response then is celebration. Now, our Bible doesn't distinguish between those four approaches, but it almost certainly comes out of an assumption of the first, that homosexuality is a choice. The whole concept of homosexuality as an innate orientation only develops in the 19th century. Before that, there's words in cultures, it's a known practice in many cultures, and there's words in lots of cultures for people who habitually choose homosexual activity or relationships, but the idea that people have a different orientation is a relatively modern development. So the Bible clearly comes out of a culture that assumes everyone has a heterosexual orientation and some people habitually choose homosexual sex. Now, modern science errs on the side of homosexuality as innate, but it cannot tell us whether that's a problem, whether that's a tragic flaw, or whether that's a gift. And which assumption we adopt will shape how we read the Bible and how we respond to each other. So just for a minute, as we step into this textual stuff, just take a sense of where you are. For you personally, is homosexuality a choice some people make? Is it a problem, an innate problem? Is it a value-neutral, sad disability? Or is it a gift? And how do you listen to someone who sits somewhere else? So I haven't even got to the Bible yet. We're already all over the place. So what does the Bible actually say? There's six texts which specifically mention homosexuality, or homosexual practice, I should say, given that homosexuality is not a concept yet. Two of them are sort of paired, so there's four real instances. There's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. There's two texts in Leviticus that are prohibitions against men sleeping with men. There's two texts, one in Corinthians and one in Timothy, where there's a list of vices that includes two words which are often translated as homosexuals. And there's a passage in the first chapter of Romans that says God has abandoned them to their degraded passions, men and women. It's the only place that mentions women engaged in homosexual sex. I'll come back to each of those four because those are the four to deep into, and I'll give those of you who are looking on your phones in a hurry, I'll give you the actual reference. I see you. There's also several references to Sodom as kind of a byword for evil. There's possible condemnations of male prostitutes in the Old Testament, but again, it's not quite sure what those refer to, but if it's male prostitutes, they're clearly condemned. Then there's some affirming discussion in the New Testament around eunuchs. Jesus talks about eunuchs. Some are born eunuchs and some become eunuchs. Now, a eunuch by nature is celibate, but the Old Testament saw eunuchs as outcasts. And Jesus seems to show a shift in attitude where eunuchs who are outside the sexual norm are included in the community. Some have suggested that when Jesus heals the centurion's servant in Luke 7 and says, "This servant is highly valued to me, please come and heal him," that this is a possible allusion to a homosexual relationship between the master and the servant that Jesus, by healing the servant and bringing him back to life, affirms. I think that's probably not that likely, but I'll put it out there that it's part of what people talk about. What I think is much more likely is the account of David and Jonathan in 1 and 2 Samuel, which describes a great love between men. They are described as dearer to each other than their own souls. David, in the song he sings at Jonathan's death, said, "His love was more wonderful to me than the love of a woman." And out of this love, several times, it says, they made a commitment and a covenant to each other. I think we have to consider that that is a possible gay relationship with one of our key Old Testament figures. I actually suspect Jonathan was gay and David just took what he could, but I don't like David very much, so I'm probably a little bit biased. It's possible that it's the first relationship in David's life. After that, he has many women, but possibly this is the foundational relationship. And the reason maybe that he has so many broken relationships with women is because this is the real one. And then there's the creation stories of Genesis, which don't specifically mention homosexuality, and that is sometimes taken by people to mean that it's excluded from God's good created order. Okay, so let's have a look at those four key passages. I'm not going to go back to those marginal ones, but the four key ones. First, Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. It's the whole of chapter 19. The traditional reading is that the sin of Sodom is that the men were homosexuals, which is evidenced by their desire to have sex with the male guests at Lot's house. They come on the door, they ask Lot to send out the guests so they can know them, which means they can have sex with them. Lot refuses. He offers to send his daughter instead. They won't have that. They try and get Lot. And then, because the guests are actually angels, they are struck with a blinding light and everyone escapes. Everyone escapes and then the city is destroyed with fire and stuff. It's not a very nice story, and if you think that's not a very nice story, the parallel story in Judges 19, where the offer of a woman instead of the guest is taken up and the concubine who's sent out is actually gang-raped until she dies, is horrific. I don't recommend reading it, but it shows the same story about failed hospitality and the use of sexual violence to violate as part of it. So the traditional reading would say the destruction of the cities indicates God's complete rejection of homosexuality. An alternate reading, first it looks at the fact that Sodom is condemned before this activity. The angels are going to Sodom because it's condemned. In chapter 18, when they talk to Abraham, this is clear. In other places through the Bible where Sodom is mentioned, the sin of Sodom is described variously. In Isaiah, it's a failure to match religious practice with action for justice. That sounds like Isaiah. In Jeremiah, their seal is adultery, lies and wickedness. In Ezekiel, pride, excess and failure to help the poor and needy. In Zephaniah, pride, scoffing at God and boasting. The only one in Jude, so we're talking later, many hundreds of years have passed by the time they write Jude, it talks about the sin of Sodom being unnatural lusts in sexual practice. We'll return to that in a little bit. So Genesis 19 illustrates one incident out of a culture of widespread wickedness. And what it illustrates is an attempted sexual attack on guests, which violates the basic hospitality code. The offence, attempted rape, is not about sex of any orientation. It's about power. And it's an attempt to shame and humiliate the visitors. It's in a patriarchal culture where the worst offence you could do to a man was to remove his manness, and sexual penetration of a man made him into a woman, essentially, in a patriarchal culture, which is why Lot offers to send out his daughter instead because it is less shameful for a woman to be sexually violated because she's still a woman than for a man to be sexually violated because it strips him of his manhood. I don't hold this view, but we're within a patriarchal culture and that's what they're talking about. And the parallel in Judges 19, where the rape does go ahead, illustrates that quite clearly, that it's the male guest who is to be shamed by whatever happens outside the door. When Jesus refers to Sodom and Gomorrah, it's in the context of he's sending his disciples out as missionaries, and he says, for those cities that do not welcome you, it'll be as if for Sodom and Gomorrah. So he also ties it to this notion of failed welcome. Another way of reading this is that the problem is not sex between men, but the attempt to have sex with angels. And there's a problem of mixing two species. And the reference in Jude seems to allude to this, that the problem is weird sexual practice attempting to have sex with angels. Now, this is a curious piece of mythology, but it's entirely irrelevant to set questions about homosexuality, if that's the issue. I don't think anyone would like to have a position as a church on whether we should or shouldn't have sex with angels. So then we'll have a look at Leviticus. The two texts are Leviticus 18:22 and Leviticus 20:13. If a man lies with a man in the same way as with a woman, it's an abomination and they should be put to death. The traditional reading is that this is a prohibition describing God's intention for all time. The severity of the punishment indicates the seriousness with which God takes the offence. And while other aspects of Leviticus are superseded by New Testament writings, moral laws are not superseded. And so this is a moral law, and therefore it applies for all time, along with the prohibitions quite nearby against incest and bestiality. How are you all going with me talking about sex like this? Like, you're not squirming too much? There's a lot in here. There's some dead silence, so I'm just a bit concerned. An alternate reading is as this takes notice. Yes, Peter.
Don't worry. I know you often say, I'll wake you up for the important bits.
I've got you. I don't need to wake anyone up for the important bits. I've got you. The alternate reading of Leviticus is that pays attention to this context of the holiness code, which is not all of Leviticus, but it is this several chapters here. It's crucial at the period to establish Israelite identity as they enter a foreign land. And one of the ways they do that is to ensure that any aspects of the Canaanite culture that they're going amongst are not permitted to enter into Israelite culture. So this idea, this may be something around that they're meeting in the culture they're entering, and if they were to take on that practice, they would become less Israelite. Now, these boundaries of who is in and who is out, are we Jew or Gentile, and what are the firm boundaries around that, is some of the main point of the writings of Paul and the Acts in the New Testament, to say those boundaries no longer apply. Christ has broken down those boundaries and we no longer have a who is in and who is out. The boundary markers don't matter. In the New Testament, they're much more concerned with the food laws and the circumcision as part of that holiness code. But it's taken to apply to the whole holiness code. Related to that, the Holiness Code is really concerned with ritual purity. There's a whole lot of stuff about keeping washing all the time and how long you can't be near anyone if you've had a wet dream or if you've had on your period. So it's cultic and ritual sins. And often those sins of ritual purity are to do with the mixing of two things, the mixing of two kinds of cloth, the mixing of different kinds of food, the mixing of sex between a human and an animal, or the mixing of sex between people of the same gender is seen as mixing the wrong things. And the word abomination, which is a terrible word in our culture, is a clue that it's about ritual, because it's a word tied to ritual and cultic activity, idolatry and cultic impurity. There's no mention of a prohibition against sex between women, because the issue is not same-sex orientation in the men, but it's about the male being a passive partner in sex. There's a real concern in this culture about who is penetrated and who is the penetrator. And men have always got to be the penetrator. They're not allowed to be penetrated because that defiles their manness. Part of being a man in this culture is to be the active partner. So you cannot be a ritually clean man if you've been acting the woman, inverted commas, in sex. And the body is used right through the Holiness Code to symbolise the people of Israel as a whole. So if in each individual, if an individual man allows himself to be penetrated rather than to be the active partner, it's taken that the whole of Israel has their manhood undermined. It threatens the integrity of the body of Israel, which is Israel as God's son. Israel, it's a male, I'm sorry, but it's a male understanding of who the people are. So the prohibitions around male-on-male sex are to do with this offence against the body of Israel because it undermines their understanding of who they are as a people. It's also possible that it's just as basic as when entering into a new land which you'd like to conquer, you need lots of people and it is not okay to waste any seed. Could be that simple. Now, we're no longer bound by the rituals and cultic norms of Israelite society over 3,000 years ago. But it's not enough to say, well, it's in the Old Testament, so we don't need to take it seriously. We need to consider what is the same and what is different between their time and culture and our context. And our holiness now is determined by our connection with Christ, not by our maintenance of cultic or cultural boundary markers. Which brings us to the New Testament. So the two vice lists, we've got 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10, and 1 Timothy 1, verse 10. And they both use the same two Greek words, malakos and arsenokortai, which just sounds like, anyway. The traditional word is that both these words clearly mean homosexuals. Or at least people practicing homosexual sex. And that indicates in this reading that the New Testament writers consider those Old Testament prohibitions to continue to be relevant even after the unifying work of Christ. An alternate reading says we're not that clear what these two words mean. Malakos literally means soft, and it was a derogatory term for anyone considered effeminate. Was also used for morally weak, cowardly, or lazy. And it appears to have been slang for male prostitutes. Those who make themselves soft and passive for other men to have sex with. Arsenokortai is a word that Paul seems to have made up. Because it's the first known instance of it. It combines two words, men, a man, and bed. Arseno is man, and koitoi is bed. Which are the same two words that the Greek translation of Leviticus uses in the prohibition. It is wrong for a man to bed with a man. And he puts them together and makes an active noun, man-bedders, essentially. So when this is paired with malakos, it could mean the active and passive partners in a homosexual encounter. Because arsenokortai is very active as a word. It could, some people have suggested, be as strong as referring to anal rape. It could be referring to homosexual slave traders. It could be referring to wanton, lewd, or irresponsible male with male sex. But it probably refers to pederasty, which was a common practice in the period. Pederasty, where older, powerful Greek men had sex with youths, even boys, or with slaves, often boy slaves. This is most likely what this is referring to. So in this translation, we are talking about then male prostitutes and men using sex as a mark of their power over children. They're also both linked with a list where there's sort of economic implications in the vices, which implies probably that we're talking about exploitation somehow rather than homosexual sex per se. Oh, how are we going? Does anyone need to stand up and shake or something? Brings us to Romans 1, verse 26 and 27, which for a lot of people is the key proof text for the condemnation of homosexual practice. That is why God abandoned them to degrading passions, why their women have exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural practices. And the men, in a similar fashion too, giving up normal relations with women, are consumed with passion for each other, men doing shameful things with men, and receiving in themselves due reward for their perversion. Now, on some ways of reading the Bible, that's a pretty closed book piece of text. It's also the only mention of homosexual relations between women anywhere in our Bible. So the traditional reading would be that this shows homosexual sex as contrary to the created intention of God and therefore wrong. And that it arises out of, this is the earlier verses give the context, arises out of an idolatrous shift away from the truth of God towards a self-serving ethic. Is there another way we can read this? It's possible that it refers to pederasty, as do the Timothy and Corinthians passages. But the inclusion of women makes that less likely. The word that's used for natural, they've given up what's natural and taken what's unnatural, is the same word that Paul uses in Corinthians when he says it's not natural for a man to have long hair. Now, I have to say, biologically, it's entirely natural for a man to have long hair. So he's not just talking about biology here. It seems he's talking about social custom, what is usual, what is customary. It is not customary. They've given up what is customary and done something not customary. But the language is still quite strong, even if that's the given. I think here we need to look at the fact that Paul almost certainly had no concept of homosexual orientation. He assumes everyone is heterosexual. So therefore, he's addressing people who he believes are choosing to act against their nature, when in fact they may be acting within their nature. By this logic, I think Paul, with a 21st century understanding of sexual orientation, may well use the exact same logic to affirm homosexual relationships because they're acting within their nature. And he would then, on the same logic, reserve this condemnation for homosexuals who entered into a heterosexual marriage. Maybe Paul did have a concept of homosexual orientation. But even if he did, some commentators have noticed that here he specifically addresses homosexuals, heterosexuals, because he states they have abandoned or given up heterosexual sex. You would not expect of a homosexual person that they would have abandoned heterosexual sex. They've abandoned this thing that they were and stepped into something that they're not. So again, the prohibition then is not relevant to people who are of a different orientation. Some people have hypothesised that, particularly the women, perhaps he's addressing a group of women whose husbands are away for many years at a time on military matters, that this happened. And they've taken up with each other in the absence, and he's saying that's not okay. This is about fidelity to your husband. You cannot just do something else while he's away. That's a hypothetical possibility. I don't know that it's got much weight, but the gist of this is addressed to heterosexual people, I think, is core. And others suggest that the issue Paul is about is lust and not orientation. That sex that is exploitative, where one partner uses the other for sexual gratification without acknowledging their full God-loved personhood, is not in line with God's intentions. So here, as in Corinthians, as in Timothy, the concern is people whose sexual urges are out of control, and that is resulting in harm to others. So all this talk about natural raises the issue of Genesis. Do the creation accounts preclude homosexuality as part of God's good order? The traditional view is because it says male and female were created, anything else comes after the fall, after sin enters, and therefore is a result of sin. The passage we read earlier about man will leave his family and become one flesh with a woman, that this is taken to indicate that marriage is about the reunification of the male and female which was separated to create Eve from Adam. And therefore, marriage by its definition can only be heterosexual. And because the Bible shows that marriage is the only legitimate place for sex, therefore by definition, because marriage is heterosexual and you can only have sex in marriage, you can't have homosexual sex. That's such a circular piece of logic that I have trouble even expressing it to you, but there we go. When Jesus refers to this passage when he's talking about not permitting divorce, he's asked a question about heterosexual relationships, and so he answers in the context of a heterosexual imagery. It doesn't necessarily mean he's not interested in anything else. And some views within this even hold that the only purpose of sex is for creation of children, that it's only in 1958 that the Anglican Church worldwide doctrine changed to allow for recreational sex within marriage. So if the only form of sex acceptable is one that can have children, then clearly homosexual sex is outside the bounds. An alternate reading looks at Genesis as an account of where we've come from. So it naturally talks in terms of male and female and procreation because that's the question it's trying to answer. But establishing this as normal doesn't therefore mean any alternative is wrong. We can equally have a minority expression that's not the norm but also good. We use normally in that way in our language. We normally come to church through the tunnel, but sometimes there's roadworks and so we take the narrows. This is not an evil second option. The emphasis of Genesis is that God created all, God created us as sexual beings, and God saw all and said it was good. Now, if I consider my heterosexuality as part of my God-created self, how can I ask an LGBTIQ whatever person to see it not part of their created self? And my heterosexuality is not just an attraction to the other sex. It's a desire to fulfill that, to have sex. And not just to think about it, but to seek a lasting relationship, a sexual relationship with a man. It's not just a theoretical identity. For me, this heart of Genesis, the God made us good, core of the creation stories, was the deal breaker that changed my theology. Because I found I could not ask of other people what I would never ask of myself. So that's what the Bible says about homosexual sex. So how do we decide how to go forward? Because it's clearly not all the same, is it? I found Kathy Thompson and Don Edwards writing about this, suggesting three guiding principles really helpful. They say the three things we need to consider when making an ethical decision are the human consequences of any ethical pronouncement must be considered. Ethics must consider relationships and not just isolated moral or immoral acts. And third, we need to remember that Jesus had a tendency to challenge norms in order to create a radical, inclusive community with special consideration for the marginalised. I think we need to acknowledge that there is an internally consistent argument that condemns homosexual practice based on the Bible. And I've held that view in the past, and much as it pains me, I have to admit that it is a valid reading of those texts. If it's your reading, though, I think you need to say it's not enough to just end there, because you also need to take seriously the teachings of Jesus and the whole Bible that call for attention to the marginalised, the oppressed and the brokenhearted. Just read the suicide statistics around people of divergent sexualities, and I can tell you for sure they are the marginalised, oppressed and brokenhearted. You need to ensure you hear the stories of actual people, not just theories, because Jesus is always clearly considering individuals, not blanket groupings. And you need to acknowledge that your reading is selective in which parts of the Bible you're going to emphasise. As is any reading, the readings that I chose for Tricia to have read in the service were very selective about what I think is core. Also, we can say the traditional reading is not the only valid reading. It is possible to affirm the Bible as important and also affirm LGBTIQ plus sexual practice. And I hope today might have given us some clues on how we can do that. But that doesn't end the story either, because it's easy to reinterpret texts and use that to absolve ourselves of the need to do anything. So if Sodom is not about sex, but about hospitality, how am I taking hospitality seriously? If Romans is calling us to act out of our God-created orientation, how am I living true? To who am I created to be? And how am I living that out with integrity? If the Bible doesn't condemn homosexual practice, it does have a lot to say about sexual ethics, which apply whether you're straight or gay, such as ensuring sex is not exploitative, holding sex within committed relationships, being respectful of your own and others' creation as sexual beings. And the Bible also calls for unity and love among Christians. How are you going to love and be in communion with those who adopt a more traditional reading? For others, it doesn't matter what the Bible says. So much of today is a curiosity. But if you wish to be followers of Jesus, I think you need to take seriously that you are bound together with others also on this path, including those for whom the Bible is absolutely central. So how are you living out Jesus' call to love one another in communion with those who cherish the book? How are you demonstrating Jesus' compassion, self-giving and sacrificial love for all people? I do not know for sure what God thinks of homosexual sexual practice. I do not know for sure what God thinks of all the specifics of my own sex life. But in anything where I cannot be sure, I think James Forbes has an appropriate suggestion to err on the side of helping hurting people and pray for mercy. Amen. It's got us all the way to nearly 11 o'clock. It was very long, I'm sorry. Would you like questions now? How are we going? Show of hands. Who wants the cup of tea now and who wants some questions? Yes, John was saying there's a paucity of references to homosexual practice in our Bible compared to other commands.
Yeah. And particularly if we go to the Old Testament, we would be doing a whole host of other things if we obeyed what the Old Testament was saying to us. Mm. I know a lot of that was related to Israel, but there's a lot more said about other practices than about homosexuality. Can you comment on that?
There is a lot more, and other things about sexual practice, there's a lot more said, particularly about fidelity is the key thing that comes up again and again around sexual practice, is fidelity. It's hard because so much of it comes out of a profoundly patriarchal culture, which has, frankly, offensive views about the role of women. It's hard for me to draw parallels to what's appropriate because so much of the teaching is just so embedded in patriarchal understandings. But the gist of fidelity and created personhood, I think, carries through. Yeah.
I found your discussion about the cultural practices in Greece interesting because I've always just assumed that the homosexuality between the masters and the young slaves was just a cultural thing. But when you were talking about it, it actually brought to mind the commotion that's been going on about sexual abuse of children in the churches and that sort of thing. And if it was more of that ilk, then yes, I can well imagine that God and his messengers might have said something negative about it.
If we were to write a text today in the light of the Royal Commission with words that said we condemn outright the actions of these men in abusing boys, and then lift it 2,000 years and have someone who doesn't speak our language read that, it is quite possible our text could be taken to say we think homosexual practice is wrong, when we know that the abuse of boys has come out in the Royal Commission is actually not to do with homosexual practice at all.
Well done.
I've got a couple of books if people want to borrow. That one's a bunch of authors writing affirming positions about gay, lesbian sexuality. This one's out of the Anglican Church in Australia, and it includes, as you would expect out of the diverse Anglican Church, both pro and anti things, but it's quite a good presentation of both sides. This one's personal stories of gay men talking about their experience with organised religion and their sense of seeking spirituality. So if finding someone to share their personal story is not within your social network, I recommend this as a way of accessing personal stories. It's heart-wrenching, I have to say, but also quite beautiful. If you want to borrow them, I'll have them. Just tell me you've taken them so I get them back.